saw Kevin Mooney earlier today, and he had his Redskins shirt on, and so he said he's wearing it while he can, you know, all this week. Yeah. Got to get that in there. We did the study your reactions are showing. Seems like a long time ago now, but we finished that study, or that study finishes with an illustration, and it's an extended illustration or an extended example of what we're talking about, and it has repeated illustrations of that as you go through the story. Most of you know the story of Joseph, and so what we'll do is we'll go through it and remind you of what's going on, and then see how some of the principles apply. And the story of Joseph is not primarily about reactions, but it's God giving us living illustrations of people's reactions when they're trusting in the Lord. And so as we go through that, you'll find that there are a number of things that really help us in seeing that we're not unique in coming to situations that are different or difficult. These are things that people have faced repeatedly throughout history. And so it's not new to God. It's not something that He's unaware of in your life when you face something like that. One of the first things we found out about Joseph was his family dynamics. And when you go to Scripture, and we looked at these two passages particularly, Joseph was in a family where there were four wives. His dad had four wives. And so he had a lot of half-brothers and half-sister. And so it was a family that was, it was an interesting family. And I often tell people that. We sometimes feel like, you know, we live in the culture where, you know, we have divorce and step families and step brothers and step sisters, and feel like we're the first ones to face that. Well, Joseph definitely faced that. And throughout the Old Testament, you find that when there were polygamous relationships. And so this is the kind of family that Joseph grew up in. One dad, but there were numerous wives. And as you go through chapter 37, you'll remember that this is where Joseph is sold into slavery. Joseph has two dreams, recounts those dreams to his brothers and to his parents. And these dreams picture him as being exalted and his family members as bowing down to him. And his brothers hate him for that. They hate him because he's the good guy, because he's the one that does right things. He brings back an evil report about his brothers, about how bad they were, tells his dad. And so his brothers really hate him. And I'm sure all these things culminated into the place where they saw Joseph coming with his coat of many colors. They're out in the fields. They come to the conclusion that they're just going to kill him. And instead of killing him, Judah is actually the one that suggests, let's just sell him instead of kill him. You know, he is our brother, so let's not kill him, let's sell him. And by the time you get to the end of chapter 37, there are four scenarios that you have to consider. Actually, I think there are five of them. And one is, are you mad at the wrong person? You know, the brothers were mad at Joseph because his father favored him. Well, it wasn't his fault. He was just doing the right thing. Are you plotting instead of solving? The brothers didn't like their situation, so they plotted and ended up coming to the conclusion, we'll just kill him. But they didn't solve their problem. They didn't really deal with the issue at hand. And there are a lot of people like that, whether it's in a marriage or in some other kind of family relationship. There's a lot of plotting that goes along, but not a lot of effort into actually solving the problem. I don't know if this one's right or not. I put it up there for a few people who might be critics of Joseph. You're right, but wrong. He tells his dream, which I don't see a problem with, but it could be wrong in that he may have been better off to keep those things to himself. I don't personally think so, but sometimes you can do the right thing in a wrong way. Then also you have people that find themselves in no-win situations. Joseph was given a coat of many colors. If he didn't wear it, who was he going to offend? His dad. Yeah, his dad gives him this beautiful coat, this wonderful gift. If he doesn't wear it, he's going to offend his dad. If he does wear it, who's he going to offend? Well, he did offend his brothers. They hated him because it was a symbol of his father's love for him and his dad's favoritism for him. And sometimes you find yourself in a situation like that, where you really feel like, I have no way out here. I'm just going to have to do what I think is best and suffer the consequences. Then the fifth thing here is, are you being prepared by God? Reactions, as you're prepared by God, He's getting you ready for something that He wants you to do. But the process is really hard. Joseph wouldn't have signed up to be sold into slavery. Even probably if he knew he was going to be second in command, he probably still wouldn't have volunteered for the path that God had for him. But God may be preparing you for something, and you have no idea what. And Joseph certainly didn't, his brothers, his father didn't, but God knew what he was preparing him for. And God was the only one that knew what he was preparing him for. So when we look at this, we come to the conclusion that God has a path for a person's life. And that path is really unknown. Just out of curiosity, there may be a couple here today. How many of you that are adults, say at least 35, are on the path that you expected to be in your life? How many of you thought, yeah, this is probably the way I'll go? All right, there are a couple. Yeah, you said, here's where I think I'll go. And sometimes the Lord lets you do that. Is there anyone here that's completely not on the path that you thought God would put you on? All right, way more of those. God has a path, a plan for us that we often have no idea about. If you would have told me when I was in ninth grade that I would have any connection with the word principal in front of my name, I would have probably tried to kill you. That was not what I was planning at all. At that point, even being a pastor, that was not in my realm of possibility. We didn't go to church when I was in ninth grade, and so I wouldn't have really planned that at all. But God had a plan, a path that I didn't know about. And here's Joseph with the same thing. There's a path that God has for him, a plan that God has for him that he doesn't know about. And sometimes that's a difficult thing, because we get on that path and we wonder if God has gone to sleep. Has he just kind of forgotten about me? I'm out here, Lord, and you know, do you know where I am and what I'm doing? Well, the answer is yes. But Joseph is a great illustration of that. Now, in chapter 37, we have the whole story. You may have put some notes in there. Turn to chapter 38 for just a second. We're not even going to spend time in chapter 38, but I want you to see it in its context. There's a story in here, and if you read chapter 38, verse 1, after they've sold Joseph to the Midianites, and they've taken him back to Potiphar, in chapter 38, verse 1, and it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he took her and went in unto her, and she conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Ur. Now, this story, if you know the flow of Scripture, often seems like it's put in here and you say, what does this have to do with Joseph? Well, the rest of the story is that he has three sons. He's married a non-Israelite, a Canaanite. God didn't want him to do that. He has three sons. His sons are involved in that culture. One of them marries a lady named Tamar. And he is so, Judah's son is so wicked that God slays him. God just plain old kills him. Says that he was so evil that God killed him. And so by the law, then his brother had to marry him or marry her, had to at least have children, and his name, his brother's name, would be preserved through that. So it's not something we do today, obviously. But the brother, in essence, refused to do it. Different circumstances, but he refused to do it. And Judah, so God killed him. And then Judah's youngest son was not old enough to marry. He said, okay, my youngest son, when he's old enough, he'll marry you. And that was the right thing to do culturally there. He didn't. And so Tamar deceived Judah. She passed herself off as a prostitute. He picked her up. Tells you a lot about him. She was pregnant. In his great righteousness, he said she should be slain as an adulteress. And she said, well, by the man whose signet this is, she had given him, or he had given her his signet that was on a necklace type thing to show who he was. And he realized that she had done the right thing. And it's this story about just immorality all the way around. And the whole purpose of the story, it has nothing to do with Joseph's story, But it shows you the kind of brothers that he had, the kind of culture that he's coming out of. And Judah forfeits his right to be the firstborn as a result of what he does. He really has shown himself to be a wicked man and a poor leader. And in spite of that, God used Tamar and her twin sons that are born to keep alive the lineage of Christ. It is a strange way sometimes that God works. Otherwise, there would have been no lineage for him. And so, here is a story in the middle of all this that just shows what Joseph comes out of. Now, keep going and go to chapter 39. When we get back to chapter 39, it picks up the story of Joseph. And we'll call the chapter Confinement. You could title it different things, but in order to understand it, we need to take the time just to work our way through it and see what's going on in Joseph's life. And so let's read the first six verses, and in the first six verses, we're going to see how a person can react, or talk about how a person can react when things are going well. Now, we'll put a caveat in there in just a minute, but let's read the first six verses and understand what's taking place. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And the Lord was with Joseph, and was a prosperous man, and he was a prosperous man, and was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, that the Lord had made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. And it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house, and over all that he owned, or all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, or on account of Joseph. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had. Or he didn't concern himself what he had, except the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. So here's in the first six verses, things are going well. Now, things are going well, but what caveat would we put in there? What's the one thing that's not going well for Joseph? He's a slave, yeah. He's been taken from his country. He's been sold into slavery. And so the whole circumstance is bad if you're Joseph. We don't know for sure, but I'm assuming he gets down to this place where the language might even be different. Certainly the culture is different. But the language is different. He's not with his family. He's been the highly favored one. He could do whatever he wanted, had freedom. And now, all of a sudden, he is a slave in Potiphar's house. Now, we look at it sometimes and we don't glamorize it, but in six verses, it doesn't seem to be all that bad. But if I were to take you to another country right now and sell you into slavery to a guy like Potiphar and he buys you, what would your attitude be like? How would you react to that? Think you'd be really happy? I don't think Joseph would say, I'm happy about being sold, but his response is certainly one that has a lot to say to us. Let's look at some of the details here, and then I'm going to ask you some questions here in just a minute. He is taken to Egypt, and if you have any, if you remember your geography, you've got the Dead Sea, and you've got Israel here, and Egypt is down here kind of on the bottom side. So Egypt down here, if you're thinking today, Jerusalem would be around the Dead Sea and up a little bit. So he's taken into Egypt, and an Egyptian officer, captain of the bodyguard is probably what this means. And so it's not just captain of the guard, but captain of the bodyguard of the Pharaoh. A couple of guesses who that was, not a name that we recognize, but captain of the bodyguard, and he purchases him. And it makes a point of saying something to us that it repeats in the Bible. Now, if you like to mark, here's one of these things that you might want to just make a little mark, maybe a little line. Look in verse 2, and in verse 2 you're going to see it at the very beginning in most translations, it's going to say, and the Lord was with Joseph. Now, just glance down through there. Do you see another time that it says that? Where's the next time? Verse 3. Yeah. If you go down to verse 3, his master saw that the Lord was with him. Now, we could put in there that it says again later, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house and talks about the Lord's blessing on him down in verses 5 and 6. But twice here, you've got it pointing out the Lord was with him. Go over to verse 21. He's going to change his location, and he's going to be in jail. But the Bible makes a point of saying, in verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph. And again in verse 23, keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him. You know, sometimes I'll hear people pray, Lord, be with that person. And I wonder if they understand what that means. Well, here's an example of when the Scripture says the Lord was with him. And its implication is that even though he's in a circumstance that would not be of his choosing, the Lord was very present, the Lord had a plan for him, the Lord was directing what was taking place. And this is what it meant when it said that the Lord was with him. And in verse 2 it goes on to say, the Lord was with Joseph. In the King James it says, and he was prosperous. New American Standard uses the word successful, and he was successful. So here's God taking this man, and in spite of the fact that he is in slavery in a country that's not of his choosing, by circumstances that are not of his choosing, the Lord is still with him in those difficult circumstances, and he's a successful man. Now keep going in the passage, and you'll find some other things. In verse 3, he had a master that had the sense to see this. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused the things that he did to prosper in his hand. And God uses all of this. He put him under under a master who had the sense, the common sense to say, this guy can get things done. Now, often we wish we would have people that would see that in other people. God's hand is upon this person. I'm going to let him do his job. If I were teaching leadership here, I would say, this is an example of somebody in a secular position who said, I'm going to turn things over to you and let you do this. He finally said, I'm going to make you overseer of all that I own. I'm going to put you in charge of it because I've seen how you work and what you do. We find people like that. God has given us some people like that in our school that just are very good at what they do. And the sense would be to say, you take care of that. God has gifted you for that. When you come down to verse 3, it makes a specific statement that I think is important for us to see. And I meant to look in the King James of how his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. That can also be the Lord caused everything he did to prosper in his hand. Here is the cause, the causation behind all of this. And I think this is important for us because sometimes you feel like you put a lot of effort into something and it doesn't succeed. And there's no reason it shouldn't succeed. But we need the Lord to make something succeed. And here's the Lord saying, I'm going to cause this to happen. And I'm often convicted by things like this, and probably there are some people in here, and I know you're driven, and you're people who are going to make things work. Have you ever met somebody that you thought that person ought to be successful, and they're not real successful? And you could go back and say, it's either because God is keeping them humble, or because they are relying completely on themselves. I know very well that God can cause Keystone Baptist Church to be successful, or he can allow it to fall apart. And it is purely based upon the fact based upon whether we rely on him to do the work or not. Same thing's going to be true in your life. You can be the kind of person that's driven, and I can tend to do that. I'm going to make things work. But how much easier it is to say, Lord, would you put your hand of blessing on this? Will you be with us as we do this? And will you cause this to be prosperous? Will you cause it to be something that's successful because you want to? So he makes him overseer. I want to ask you a question, because in my mind, even when I was going through this, how long was Joseph in Potiphar's house? How long did it take him to go from purchased slave to overseer? Let me just ask you this. When you read the six verses, how long does it seem like it took? Yeah, who said that? Not very long. That's how it is when I read it. I'm thinking, all right, he bought him, and 2 days later he said, wow, this guy's good, and watched him for maybe a month, and then 2 months later he made him the overseer of his house, and yeah, he was in his position pretty quickly. And so I did a little study, and I actually hit a slide here because sometimes I get a little too deep in it. But you can take the dates and you can figure out dates, but I hid that slide because we don't really need to know the dates. Let me work backwards a little bit. When we get to chapter 41, verse 46, it will tell us that Joseph is 30 years old when he becomes second in command in Egypt. So we know at the time that he became second under Pharaoh in Egypt that he is 30 years old. All right, your quiz today. How old was he when he was sold into slavery? 17. You're 1 year off, but you're close. Yeah. He was 17. So, we take that and we do a little math tonight. 30 minus 17. Yeah, we've got 13 years. And actually, we can't really narrow it down any further than that. We can come close. We know that he was 13 years from the time that he was sold into slavery to the time that he got that position as being second in command in Egypt. And in that time, only two things happened. One was this event where he was sold into Potiphar's house. The other is when he's falsely accused and ends up in prison. And remember the baker and the butler and the circumstances, he's left in prison. And so help me out a little bit. Some of you who can remember the story, he went to the jail shortly after he was in there. The baker and butler were put in there, and then you have the circumstances where they have the dream. He interprets the dream, and then he's forgotten about for a little while. How long do you think that jail experience was?
2 years.
All right, well, 2 years, okay. Why longer? Okay, yeah, all right. So you want to go with 3, 4, 5? You don't have 15 to work with. All right, 3.5. All right, 3.5. Do I hear 4? All right, we got a 4 back there. I think 4 would be a lot. Now, we have the same thing here. He's going to become the guy who's in charge of the prison. So a little time is going to pass for that. But in this circumstance, he already knows the language. Potiphar sends him there, but Joseph would be known by this time. And it's the king's prisoner, so it's not just the ruffians that are put in there. It's the people the king was mad at. And so let's just say 3 years. We don't really know, but I think 3 is probably longer. I'd be more inclined to go with 2 at, you know, in that neighborhood. Let's say 3. So how long was he in Potiphar's house? 13 minus 3? 10. 12. Yeah. 10 years. So we can say that the events of verses 1 through 6 took about 10 years. Now, think that through a little bit, because often we think about Joseph and we think all of this happened really rapidly. But here's this 17-year-old. He's taken into captivity, or he's taken it, sold into slavery, and Potiphar buys him, and pretty soon, about, you know, 18 years old, he's the overseer in charge of everything. That may not be the way it was. It may have been that he was there a year, maybe a year and a half before he was really promoted. I think he was recognized pretty quickly for his skill, but he's probably kind of suspect a little bit. Is he going to run away? Is he going to try to get back to his Hebrew roots? So I don't know how long he was there, but what we can say is that somewhere in the neighborhood of around 10 years, He endures. We kind of have the idea that this was a short-lived thing. But he went down there, all this happened really rapidly, and he didn't have to go through the long haul. 10 years is a long time. That's a long time to be a slave. It's a long time to be faithful in a job you didn't volunteer for. It's a long time to be consistent. It's a long time to maintain your integrity. And when I think of Joseph, you know, if you think of it in that sense, here's a guy that has far more consistency than I initially thought of. Because for 10 years, he has to endure this situation, and not just endure it, but he has to prove himself and elevate himself, or allow the Lord to elevate him to this position. When you get to verse 6, it makes the outright statement, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. At some point, Potiphar had recognized that Joseph was such a skilled person and that God was with him so much that he said, you take care of everything. You be the steward. You be the manager of my house. And it says that he didn't consider anything except the bread which he ate. The food which he personally ate was the only thing that he considered in his own house. Joseph took care of everything. That takes some time. To build that kind of relationship, it takes a lot of time. You'll work with people for years before you have that kind of trust and that kind of camaraderie, even in this situation, to say, I'm just going to let you take care of it. You have the keys to the kingdom, as it were. And so Joseph's there a long time. Verse 6 in the King James says, Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored. Interestingly, the New American Standard says that he was handsome in form and appearance. So here's a guy that's in great shape, and he's the hunk. He's this guy that people look at, and the girls would take the second look and say, "Ooh, nice looking guy." You know, the Bible points that out for us. And so here he is in a good circumstance. Now, in spite of the fact that he's a slave, God is blessing. God is doing good things for him. He's had 10 years of prosperity. He's got a great future. How do people react in circumstances like that? If you find yourself in that or know of other people that are in those circumstances, yes, there's always something to complain about, but things are going real well. How do people normally react? Okay, they might take it for granted. Yeah? Okay. What would you normally think, though? It's not a trick question. How would you react if things were going well? Okay, it might become complacent, but what'd you say? Pretty much, that's my thought. I don't really have anything to complain about. It's pretty easy to react properly when things are going well. Yes, you can take it for granted. Yes, you can become complacent. I think you're less likely to do that in Joseph's case because, number one, you're a slave. Number two, you're a foreigner. And we'll see in just a minute, the fact that he is a Hebrew does not endear him to the people who are around him. And so I think he has to be constantly vigilant, but I think by and large, he would look to heaven and say, God has been really kind to me. And God has, boy, in spite of the fact that I'm not where I expected to be, I'm not on the path that I thought I would be, God has been good, and I have nothing to complain about. Given the choice, I'd probably go back home, but boy, things are really good. And by and large, I think this is one of those where we could look at it and say, things are going well, my reaction would be good. But reacting when things are going well and reacting when things are not going well are two different things. And sometimes Satan will use this kind of circumstance to blindside an individual. So let's just briefly look at what takes place. Let's go to verse 7. And it came to pass, after these events, that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph. That would also be translated that his master's wife looked with desire upon Joseph, and she said, "Let me make you a proposition. Lie with me." Obviously, it's an invitation to an adulterous relationship. But he refused and said unto his master's wife, "Behold, my master wotteth not," or doesn't concern himself with what is in the house, "and he has committed all that he has to my hand or to my charge. There is none greater in this house than I. Neither has he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And it came to pass, as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass at this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business or do his work, and there was none of the men of the household there within. And she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out or went outside. And it came to pass when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto the men of her house or men of her household and spake unto them, saying, "See, he," or Potiphar, "has brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us," or to make sport of us. "He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice," or "I screamed. And it came to pass, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and screamed, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up his garment by her," or left his garment beside her, "until his lord," or his master, "came home. And she spake unto him according to these words, saying, 'The Hebrew slave which thou hast brought unto us came in to me to mock me," or to make sport with me. "And it came to pass as I lifted up my voice and cried," or screamed out, "that he left his garment with me and fled. And it came to pass, when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, 'After this manner did thy servant unto me,' that his wrath was kindled." Now let's stop there, because here we've got now a whole different circumstance. Here's a man who's doing his work. He's making the best of the situation that he's in and probably reacting pretty good on a regular basis. Now what happens when life falls apart? Not just falls apart, but unfairly falls apart. There are several interesting phrases in here. It says that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. Again, one of those things that we sometimes think that we're exclusive in our culture. How long has adultery been around? As long as a man has been around. How long has pornography been around? Well, in different states today, we have computers, but pornography's been around since men and women were on the earth, just in different forms. How long has lust, in the negative sense, been around? Again, it's not new to us. And so here's a man who finds himself pursued by a woman. And again, this is something that's not new. This is a circumstance way back in the 1800 BCs. That is a circumstance that, you know, we see repeated today. And Joseph gives us an understanding of what our worldview should be. What is Joseph's worldview? What is a worldview to start with? Do you have a worldview? Actually, everybody has a worldview, but you may not have defined your worldview. Can anybody define a worldview for me? Sheba, you should be able to define a worldview because we read a book on it 2 years ago. I don't remember the exact definition either, so you're okay. Worldview, give me an idea. What is it? Todd? There's the key word, yeah. It is the set of beliefs or values that you have through which, we often call it the lens through which you interpret the events that are around you. Without being political, you know, you have the president who has exerted his efforts at gun control. Well, depending on your worldview, you either see that as awful, or there are some people who say, "This is the most wonderful man in the world. He's protecting the children." See, we're not making this political, Andy. But your worldview determines how you see that. Your worldview determines how you interpret even the socialistic slant that many of the candidates have. Your worldview is how you interpret the events that are taking place around you. What is Joseph's worldview? He actually says to us what his worldview is in this verse. Aaron? Yeah. Look at verse 9 specifically. He makes an argument, and then he actually goes away from his argument. He answers the lady and says, you know, the master of the house has elevated me. I mean, I have a wonderful position, and he's kept back nothing from me except you. And the reason he's kept you back from me is because you're his wife. And the rest of the argument should be, since you're his wife, I cannot take you because you're not mine. And he's given me everything. He's been so kind to me. But look, I can't take you. The argument goes actually in a different direction when he finishes. He says, God, the master has put me in charge of everything in the house, and he hasn't kept back anything from me except you, and that's because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Who was his ultimate master? God. This reveals for us a huge thought pattern in Joseph's life. Joseph was not captivated by his position and captivated by the power he had. He was still understanding there's a God that I have to give an answer to. Regardless of the pleasure that you offer me, and he would look at you and say, we could have a great time till we get caught, and then my head goes, and maybe yours. Regardless of what happens, I have to answer to God. And here's his worldview. And I believe that God is sovereign, and that God is going to observe what I do. There is so much in this statement. I can't hide anything that goes on from God. And how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? It reveals to us his value system. He said, God has given us a standard of behavior. It's not the master's standard of behavior, but God has said, thou shalt not commit adultery. And so I can't do this evil and sin against God. I am so concerned about sinning against God that there are some things I cannot do, and this is one of them. I cannot be unfaithful. I cannot get into this relationship because you're another man's wife. And he wouldn't do it. This is his worldview. And it begins to reveal to us in a number of statements in Joseph's life what how he perceives God. Later on, he's going to say, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. It reveals what he thinks of God. But yes, you look at it and say, this is an awful circumstance. God was doing something through it. And here he says, you know, I'm under God's guidance and God's leadership. I just can't do this. This is not something that I can permit myself to do. And when we come to the end of this particular study, this is going to be one of the things that we're going to say, is that he has the right perception of God, and that's why he can react the way he does. If we were to stop here and take the time, and I don't think we need to do it, I don't think it would even be healthy for us, but if you're thinking in a purely carnal fashion, without a regard for God, can you give the arguments of why it would be all right for him to take this lady's offer? Well, I think every carnal person can do that. And that's what happens to us often, is we fall into carnality and fleshly. We want to defend the flesh and defend the things that we want to do. And he had the ability to say, you know what? I'm going to hold my ground. I'm going to stick firm to what I know is right, and I'm not going to do the evil things and sin against God. And that's where I'm going to stand. I know it's wrong, can't do it. And so here's his reaction. Things are going to get a lot worse for him, but this is the foundation that they're going to get worse on. This is an unfair situation. He shouldn't have to be in this, but he is in it. and he learns to react the way that God wants him to react. All right, we're out of time tonight. Next week, we'll come back to this. We'll finish chapter 39, and it'll put us in a completely different setting and continue to ask the question about how to react when things don't go the way that we expect them to. All right.